Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me start with some baseball. I've got a lot of other ways I want to go, but I do want to start here. Like, when you think of the great rivalries in Major League Baseball, what do you think of? Red Sox, Yankees, Giants, Dodgers, Cards, Cubs. I mean, those are the ones that come to mind immediately. But if that's your list, you are overlooking one of the better feuds in Major League Baseball. And last night, we got another edition of it. I'm talking about CC Sabathia and the Tampa Bay Rays. That's right. CCV Tampa. I mean, one of the stranger low-key feuds in all of sports, not just baseball. And if you have not been paying attention, now is the time to get caught up. Let me give you a little background. CC has dominated the Rays the last 2 years with an ERA of less than 2.4 in the last seven starts. And he was tossed from a game against the Rays late last year for dotting a Rays batter. How seriously did he take that plunking? Remember, it led to a suspension, which cost him $500,000 in bonus money for innings pitched last season. Think about that for a minute. I mean, sure, the Yankees did pay him the bonus nonetheless, but it was more important to CeCe. Like, he didn't know that at the time. It was more important to CeCe to defend a teammate and hit a member of the Rays than it was to stack that cash. And don't come in here and tell me that he can't spend what he already has, that his kids' kids won't get to what he already has. That's $500,000 that he knew he was going to lose because it was more important to him to defend a teammate. And that tells you all you need to know about that guy. And it tells you all you need to know about what kind of a teammate CeCe is. Oh, and it tells you all you need to know about how much he hates the Rays. It tells you that as well. Remember earlier this year, he threw at Tampa's Austin Meadows three times and allegedly shouted insults at the Rays. So now you know, this is one of the more underrated feuds in all of sports, not just baseball. It brings us to last night in the Bronx. Sabathia v. Avisail Garcia. Two outs in the sixth. And let me tell you, the end of the inning is not the end of the action. Let's get it on.
Beautiful pitch, and he got him. Went to the breaking ball. Maybe got a little benefit, a little outside.
You're right.
Take a look. But he's a veteran, B.A. Oh, hold on. Things heating up. Garcia had some words. Sabathia has to be held back, and the bench is clear.
Garcia not real happy. I think Sabathia said something, yelled at him right there, a couple of things. Yeah, Sabathia started it.
They're still going. That's what it was.
Well, you know what? Sabathia's been chirping at these guys for a while. It's about time that someone says enough.
It didn't look like Garcia was in that mode at all.
He was going down to take off his ankle guard, and Sabathia had some words for him.
Doesn't drowning pool make everything better? Even if they're just jawing at each other? All right, so that was the Rays call. And let's not get carried away with this notion that Garcia was standing up to CeCe. That was a classic baseball benches clearing incident where nobody wants to do anything at all because nobody's exactly sure about what is even happening in the first place. Nobody knows why benches are clearing in the first place. They just know that part of the code is getting up off your ass and pretending like you do want to knock somebody the hell out. Because the code also says if you don't do that, you'll get knocked out by one of your own. But again, exactly what was the offense there? What happened? Which appendix of the baseball code that's written in invisible ink was violated? Was Garcia pissed that CeCe stared at him? Was CeCe pissed that Garcia stared him down? I mean, what happened here? What was so wrong? Afterwards, Garcia said, quote, nothing happened. Afterwards, Sabathia said, quote, it was a misunderstanding. So a weird feud somehow just got even more weird because there's a lot of big bodies running in from the outfield and off the benches and clearing the dugouts, but nothing happened. Yeah, nothing happened. Nothing that I could see other than a couple of guys just looking at each other. I guess we can add that to the long list of reasons to go. He threatened me. He threatened somebody close to me. He spit in my face. He insulted my race or my religion. He looked at me. Because essentially, CeCe was looking at Garcia like, The hell are you looking at, scrub? He even appears to be saying to Garcia, if I was talking to you, I'd be talking to you, which is true. And if he was trying to hit you, he would tell you that too, because after he went after Meadows back in May, he left the mound yelling, quote, I definitely was trying to hit his ass, end quote. So afterwards, Sabathia still said he was not talking to Garcia.
I wasn't talking to him. And, you know, he looked up at me and said something, and it was on.
Were you talking to the umpire?
No, I was just yelling out, like kind of pumping myself up, sorry. And, you know, he might have took offense to it, but, you know, it is what it is. I'm never going to back down.
Now, we know that about CeCe. He's never going to back down. The only way he wasn't getting into the middle of that weird fight as part of this weird feud was if somebody stopped him and somebody got in between him and Garcia. And because I still don't know what happened or didn't happen that led to that benches clearing brawl, let's just go all CSI on a different call of the incident. And please be warned, there appears to be some personal appearance smack coming up in this.
Ruckus going on. Let's see what happens, Paul.
To say, you know, CeCe doesn't want anybody staring at him. Garcia doesn't want anything, but it just, you know, these are two teams that are going to go at it, and they've gone at it before. So it doesn't take much to get them going.
Look at Dita trying to hold CeCe back. He's going to need some help.
Yeah, you might be right about that.
It's like he's saying, you're talking a lot of close games between these two teams.
Yeah.
On edge.
I'm going to talk to you. I'll talk to you.
Yeah.
You hear that quote? Look at Didi trying to hold CeCe back. He's going to need some help. End of quote. But actually, he didn't. Shout out to Didi, who's listed at 205, holding back CeCe, who's probably about 50% more than that. Except Didi used classic technique. He got low. He got leverage. He drove with the legs. He kept CeCe from getting into it as the bench is cleared. Gregorius even took a shot to the neck from CeCe as Sabathia was gesturing, but he stayed strong, even through it. Quote, it felt like holding a bear. And then when the dust settled, both teams were warned, and then the Yankees went to work. Homer in the bottom of the inning to make it 3-2 Rays, followed by a two-run shot in the eighth from Aaron Judge. And then, here comes the bear keeper himself, Didi Gregorius, with the bases juiced.
Two out. Bases loaded. 1-2. Drill! Deep right field! No doubt about it! Grand slam for Didi Gregorius into the bleachers in right field! And the Yankees have busted this game open here in the bottom of the eighth. It's now 8-3.
Have yourself a day, Didi. Hold back Sabathia. Snap your slump with a grand slam. Yankees win a beatdown 8-3. So CeCe Sabathia is going to retire at the end of the season, which is a drag. It's sad for so many different reasons. He's a legend. There's nobody else like him in Major League Baseball. A guy with more than 250 wins, more than 3,000 strikeouts, and one awesome, awesome, weird feud. Not only do I want him to keep, or do I not want him to retire, I want him to keep playing long enough so that he can have a feud with the Rays in Tampa and Montreal. One weird feud with the same team in two different cities and two different countries. That's what baseball needs. It's exactly what we need. Jungle legend, Steve Elkington. Mate, what's going on? How are you?
G'day, Jimmy. How are you, mate?
Great, great. Elk, how about you? G'day. How you feeling?
Yeah, mate, down here in Houston. It's about 112. The mosquitoes are up. I'm ready to roll.
Nice. All right, so the Open starts tomorrow at Royal Portrush. Before we get into some of the players, Elk, what is your sense of that course and how to play it?
You know, I'm hearing, you know, everything that I'm hearing coming back from them. I've been to Ireland. I've never played Portrush, but they're saying it's probably one of the top three courses they've ever seen. All the guys are just saying it's magnificent. It's one of these unusual pieces of property that sort of, if it was in California, mate, it'd be covered with, you know, Four Seasons and million-dollar homes. But in Ireland, they've left these special, you know, peninsulas that hang out on the ocean. And, of course, it's been there for hundreds of years where they've done this magical course. And it's very undulating. You know, this course is going to be a little different than some of the others that they've seen because this has so much undulation, so many drop-offs that you can really get a, you know, a sideways bounce. And everyone's saying that, you know, you've got to keep this ball in the fairway. It's really nasty off the fairway.
Summer's heat can be draining on your vehicle's battery, and rising temps can cause battery fluids to evaporate altogether. You want to stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts right now so you can have your battery tested free of charge. If your battery does need to be replaced, the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts will help you find the exact superstar battery that fits your car or truck at a guaranteed low price. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. All right, so generally, what kind of a mentality do you have to win the Open?
You know, I finished second, and I've lost in a playoff in 2002. I wasn't a very good links player when I first went over there. The turf's different. It's very firm, and you've got to hit the ball a little differently. You've got to flight it so you don't get a lot of spin on it, because when you get playing in the wind and you're playing crosswind, you know, these balls go everywhere. So it's just patience, mate. It's you know, Brooks Koepka says it so perfectly. You know, he makes all these double bogeys and triple bogeys when he plays on the regular tour, but over in the US, over in the majors, he never seems to make a big number, and he's very patient. He stays away from these bunkers that are essentially, they look terrible on TV. They're like jacuzzis all over the golf course, but he stays out of them. And then when he does get in one, he just comes out sideways. So you don't try to compound your error. So it's very much a sort of a attitude, Jim. It's, you know, it's a real test, mate. And I know that you are a big horse guy. This is a different track. This is a different track that takes a certain amount of discipline to be good at.
Steve Elkington is joining us to talk Open Championship and other things. I'm going to get back to Brooks Koepka in a minute, Elk, but what about Rory McIlroy? He is the local favorite, and he grew up playing in Hollywood, which is about an hour away. Do you think that playing so close to home is going to be a good thing or a bad thing for him?
He's going to have the most pressure of anyone that's probably ever teed it up in an Open Championship. And of course, he holds a course record there. He shot 61 when he was 16 years old, so of course, he's been an amazing golfer for, you know, ages. But, you know, everybody knows that he's lost the razor's edge that Brooks Koepka has right now and Dustin Johnson had, and, of course, Tiger has absolutely delivered with for 20 years. He's lost that razor's edge, and I don't know what it is, and I'm not even sure he does, but could it be that the magic could happen in Ireland? Mate, it could. He's certainly one of the most gifted players from tee to green, but I think it's an open field this week. Everybody's in the game this week.
Steve Elkington joining us. Elk, take one more run at that. Like, what do you think that is? I mean, he's not obviously seen to be like the same guy he was mentally when he was running off majors a few years back. I mean, do you get the sense that maybe he's comfortable where he is? Maybe the fire has gone out? If you had to put your finger on it, what do you think it is?
Well, he was quoted this week as saying that he was watching the video of him shooting 61 that was on the TV, and he said, man, I wish I had some more of that. And I was waiting for him to hear, well, what was more of that? And he said, I was really cocky and really brash, and I knew I was going to do it. And, you know, he's a little bit more shoulder shrug, what happened type of attitude. Mate, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what that edge is, and I don't think anyone does, to be honest. I mean, we knew that when Tiger came to an event, it was on, mate. It was on, and same right now with Brooks. And now Tiger finds himself in a very unusual position of sort of defending his attitude a little bit, which has been really unusual for me to see.
Steve Elkington joining us. No, I think that's fair, too. You know, I mean, you could talk about any number of athletes in any number of sports when they get to the mountaintop or they win that major, they win that championship. Sometimes the hunger goes out. Oh, and speaking of hunger, why don't we talk Hefty for a minute? What do you make of Phil Mickelson posting on Instagram that video talking about going on a 6-day fast and losing 15 pounds?
Hefty, mate. He's selling this again, mate. Not only that, have you ever heard anyone that's going on a fast that broke down the ingredients that's in the fast? I mean, who wants to know that? I mean, he's gone full earth mode, mate. Full earth mode. He said this course is spiritual, the tournament's spiritual. Well, you know what, Hefty? Maybe you want to dribble a little Frankenskank essential oil on your tea bowl. That's going to be better than going on a diet for 6 days, mate.
Oh, man. Look, it's no it's no secret, Elk, that Phil has been known to put away some grub. He might even be able to put away a custard castle, but is his weight really the problem with his game right now?
nah, mate, it's his swing. He's not hitting the ball straight. You know, he doesn't have that ideal mechanical. You know, I talked to the TaylorMade guys when Sam and I were out at the U.S. Open. They were saying, why is Phil Mickelson not a good driver like Rory McIlroy? And, you know, the data shows it, that the shaft doesn't have as much lean on it and impact. His is underneath the other way. And that's just a sort of a you know, a mathematical way of saying he's not very good, you know. But, mate, how come me? How come I'm the poor guy that can't get a couple of images out of my head? Like, how come I was in the wrong place at the wrong time when I saw Colin Montgomery when he great whited four Big Macs, and then I was at another place where I saw friggin' Mickelson just vacuum six chocolate eclairs? How come I'm the one that was in the wrong place at the right time? I cut these images, seared into my head, and now Monty's, now Hefty's come out when he's dropping this new move on me where he's got all these, he's eating coffee. I mean, come on. Come on, Hefty. That's not the way you get ready for the Open. You drink 10 Guinness. That's, everyone knows when you go to the British, you eat, you do 10 Guinness.
Or you vacuum six chocolate eclairs. So, Elk, bottom line, I mean, was the Instagram video really an update on his preparation for the Open, or is he playing us all once again? Is he laying the groundwork for another product pitch, like when he was trying to sell everybody on the notion of golfing in dress shirts? Are you going to be having some of his, quote, special coffee blend for wellness?
Mate, he's even dropped the Yeti cup. I mean, this is coming, right? I've got to buy some dress shirts. I've got to do the tight undershirt. I've got to buy two drivers to play the course. Mate, I'm just exhausted. I'm just exhausted from seeing this. I can't watch it. It's too much. It's too heavy. Go back to the vacuum move, Hefty. You won 42 times with the vacuum hooked up.
You won 42 times with the vacuum hooked up. All right, Elk, the last time you were on, we talked about the new app that had just launched. 1 month later, how is the app going?
It's going really well. You know, we had our, you know, big launch at the U.S. Open, and this is our second week, which is the Open Championship. We're doing really well. It's getting the word out. And, mate, Hawk opened the game the other day. Hawk beat me in the game that we played at the U.S. Open, which was a little bit perplexing coming from Hawk, who's obviously doesn't know the in-depth of the tour like I do. However, mate, we've decided that we're going to open a big game this week, and he's already invited about 30 clones in, and I think we're going to sweeten this pot just a little bit. I think we've decided, he and I and you, hopefully, that we're going to let the clones email into Hawk's DM their email, and we'll put them in that $10 game. And I'm going to sweeten it, Jim. I'm going to do a tune for anyone that can beat us or who wins the game, and a bottle of Fuzzy's vodka signed by the man himself, Masters Champion.
Wow. All right, so just so we're really clear on this, Elk, how do the clones get the app? How do they get involved? And again, run that by me one more time. Run that back. What is the prize?
So we're going to, you go to the iTunes store, you go to the App Store, and you'll download SG Tour gaming app, register. You have to have a PayPal to play. Then you will, if you want to be in me and Hawk's game, you'll email Hawk to his DM on Twitter, and we'll add you to that game. We got room for I got room for another 100 guys. So we've got about 40 in there right now, and we want to do a big game. So it'll be $10, you know, it'll be $1,000 in this game. And I think Hawk can confirm this with you right there. I think he did first, second, and third. So it might be, mate, it might be a $500 or $600 pot.
I like
for the
it.
Winner.
I like that a lot. What you should do, clones, if you want to do this, and I'm shocked that it's not already filled up, go to Hawk's Twitter feed right now. All the information's right there, and I love it. Elk, before you go, let me ask you about Brooks Koepka, who you mentioned. You know, it's crazy we got to the end of this thing before we talked about him in a major, and we know the way he uses his fuel. He'll probably find something out this week about something and use it as fuel. How do you like his game coming into this week?
I like him the most of anyone. He's finally, someone out there's finally had the cards to just say, you know what, this is what I'm doing, okay? I'm doing this. I don't care about you. He whiffed Tiger the other day. I didn't play with him. I watched him practice. He's just putting one putt. Mate, his caddy is from Port Rush. And here's the deal this week, okay? This course has a lot of dog legs. And, of course, a lot of these players can play it the safe way where they don't have to cut across the corner. However, when it gets windy, those across-the-corner shots become a new line because the wind changed. Well, guess what? He's got the local boy on the bag. So, you know what? Koepka's a freak. I love this guy. And if he pulls off his fifth major, what is his Sheila going to wear to the ESPYs if she had the crochet top on the other day, babe? Holy moly, did you see that, Jimmy?
It seemed like it was only about a week ago that I was playing some awkward and cringy audio of Tiger Woods screaming a 1 a.m. wake-up call to a giant corporation in an attempt to get his body clock shifted for the Open at Royal Portrush. It seems like it was only a week ago because it was only a week ago.
Hey, Nike, it's Tiger. Wake up! It is now 1 a.m. here on the East Coast. Why am I doing this right now? Because it is now 6 a.m. at Royal Portrush. I'll be playing the Open Championship there. In order to be prepared for the time chase, I'm getting up. If you want to succeed, if you want to get better, if you want to win, you want to accomplish your goals, well, it starts with getting up early in the morning. Have a great day.
Thanks, Jocko. Oh, Jocko Willink right there. It starts with getting up early in the morning. Like, if Jocko says it, that's one thing. Tiger's like, hey, Nike, it's Tiger. Yeah, no bleep. Really? That was 7 days ago. 7 days ago, the cat was giving all of his addicts plenty of pure, uncut, honk, crack to overdose on. All the while looking and sounding like he was on the White Rock himself or something. I mean, look at our guy waking up at 1 a.m. to get his body right for the Open. Man, give the guy the claret jug right now. Tiger by a million. Get in the hole. I will be playing Open Championship there. All right, so that's a week ago, and all the Tiger honks were peaking. And Tiger had it all worked out. I guess a lot can change in a week. I guess because the whacked out 1 a.m. Tiger from last week is now a solemn, almost resigned Tiger this week. You heard him then. Now check out this dude at his presser from Northern Ireland on Monday when he was describing the intense emotional toll that winning the Masters took on him.
Well, getting myself into position to win the Masters was it took a lot out of me. That golf course puts so much stress on the system. And then if you look at that leaderboard, you know, after Francesco made the mistake at 12, it seemed like 7-8 guys had a chance to win the golf tournament with only, what, 6 holes to play. And so it became very crowded. A lot of different scenarios happened. I was reading the leaderboard all the time, trying to figure out what the number is going to be, who's on what hole. And, yeah, it took quite a bit out of me.
Uh-oh. Mixed messages much? Never mind. Have you ever heard that guy sound like that? Wow, there were like so many guys in the mix. There were a lot of guys on that leaderboard. Looking back and reading the leaderboard really took a lot out of me.
So much stress.
So much stress. Forget for a minute that this is Tiger freaking Woods who won the Masters. Let's just go back to the same guy 7 days ago who was bouncing off the walls, ready to rip number 16. And now he's telling the world that keeping an eye on the leaderboard during the Masters really took a lot out of him. He literally said that. Keeping score took a lot out of him. What the hell does that even mean? Is dude still fried from April despite playing next to no golf at all since then? Is he sitting on E? Is the tank empty? Or even worse, is running down Jack actually the furthest thing from his mind now? Is he actually good after shocking the world and ripping the green jacket? In other words, is he done paying the price? Is he happy just to walk off on that stunning win at the Masters? I mean, if so, great. It sure as hell looks like it. It feels like it, because dude's not paying the price. He's not preparing. Hell, he's not even playing. You always hear that, hey, no matter what's going on, he's still Tiger Woods. You can never count him out. Yes, you can, and I am. And apparently so is he. And never mind me counting him out. He's counting him out. for all the reasons I just mentioned. He has not played enough. He's not prepared. He's not confident. And just wait until that bad weather kicks in and he's walking that track like he's got a piano strapped to his back. So hell yes, I'm counting this guy out. Just making it to the weekend will be a big win for the big cat this week. And if watching the leaderboard took that much out of him on a course he absolutely loves, how is it going to be walking a course that he knows nothing about and actually has to pick up the bats and swing them? This is just dude running his cat playbook to perfection. If somehow Elgato plays well this week, then he did it in spite of being mentally exhausted from watching the leaderboard way back in April. Then he's a legend. But if it goes the other way, and it will, and he sprays it all over the yard and he misses the cut, then he's got everybody pointing back to his presser on Monday where he said that he wasn't properly prepared and that everybody was properly warned that he was not going to compete in the tournament. Legend if he plays well, but expected and justified if he doesn't. Typical tired cat spin. No honks. Your idol is not going to be a factor this week. I'm looking at you, Hawk. I'm looking at all you honks. He essentially said as much. Not only has he not picked up a bat since Pebble, he's never actually stepped foot on this track until right now. And the two guys who are favored to win have a huge local advantage. Rory McIlroy grew up in Northern Ireland. He set the course record at Portrush way back in 05 when he was 16. Then you've got Brooks Koepka, his bagman. Ricky Elliott is a Portrush native. He knows that setup better than anybody out there. And he's going to be giving numbers and carry yardage to the best player on the planet all week long. And if you think Tiger doesn't know that, then you don't know the cat. Because the cat tried to cozy up to Brooks after the U.S. Open this year and work his way into a practice round this week with Koepka and his looper.
Tell you a funny story. I texted Brooksy, you know, congratulations on another great finish. I said, hey, dude, you know, you mind if I, you know, tag along and play a practice round? I've heard nothing.
Man, it must be so nice. It must be so nice to run out material like that and have everybody laugh. When it's not funny at all. If you or I tried that, you'd get crickets. You'd get Lee Evans'd. Ghosted! Brooks Koepka. Straight ghosting the cat on iMessage. Hey, dude, can I play with you and your caddy and steal some local knowledge before the Open? Either that is the most savage move of all time from a guy who's not going to give an inch, or Tiger has some old digits. Because the best story of the year might be too good to be true. Remember, Koepka told reporters after the U.S. Open that he was getting too many texts from randos, so he changed his number. Maybe he never gave the new one to the cat. And maybe somebody with Brooks's old digits got a text from a number that they didn't recognize asking them to play a practice round at Portrush.
Hey, it's Tiger.
Or maybe Koepka did ghost Eldrick. I can't say how badly I want that to be true. Waxing the alleged greatest golfer of all time at the PGA this year while being in the same group is one thing, but ignoring his texts for a practice round is another. And until Brooks comes out and says that Tiger was texting an old number, I'm just going to choose to believe that he ghosted the cat. Speaking of Brooks, this is a guy who has somehow managed not to have a major emotional toll taken out of him despite having to watch the leaderboard himself, despite winning one major already this year and finishing second in each of the others too. And he had himself a bit of an Allen Iverson moment when he was asked this week how he prepares for tournaments.
I just practice before the majors, regular tournaments, I don't practice. If you see me on TV, that's when I play golf.
In other words, practice. Practice? We're talking about practice?
We're talking about practice. Not a game. Not the game that I go out there.
Not a major. Not the thing I kill myself for.
Play every game like it's my last.
Not the Masters.
We're talking about
not the Open. We're talking about a major?
How silly is that, man? We're talking about practice.
We're talking about one of the 18 Buick Classics?
I'm supposed to lead by example. I know that. And I'm not shoving it aside.
Driving range,
you know,
please.
Like it don't mean anything.
I'm not saying that John Deere doesn't mean anything.
I honestly do.
But I mean, I do. I honestly do. We talk about practice?
practice?
Putting drills before the Sony? Putting drills? You tell me again that Brooks has no personality. Tell me again how boring Brooks is. Tell me that the guy who told players to stop crying about the U.S. Open setups is a big bore and a dud and a snoozer. Tell me that that guy who might, and hopefully ghosted the cat and copped to not practicing before regular tournaments is so boring and dry and uninteresting. Well, you know what? Don't. Don't ever tell me that again, because right now I would rather listen to Brooks read the phone book than have Hefty sell me a six-day blended coffee fast, or have the cat tell me that watching the scoreboard in April took a giant toll on him. You got your guy, I got mine. Daniel Jeremiah is my guest. DJ, good to have you back. How are you?
How you doing, Ron, man? It's nice. Football season, it's almost here, man. We made it.
It is your time of year. NFL camps, DJ, starting to open up today. You've got rookies reporting for the Cardinals, the Ravens, the Seahawks, and both rookies and vets reporting for the Broncos. How excited do you get this time of year?
Oh, it's just so fun, man. I'm like, you do top five lists and you can do predictions, but like, look, everybody's just talking out of their butt. Like, let's see these guys on the field and find out who's going to be good this year. That's when the fun starts.
Man, that is true. Everybody is talking out their butt right about now. Daniel Jeremiah joining us. All right, so from a team perspective, how important is it for the teams and what they're hoping to accomplish this time of year?
Well, I think it's huge. I think when you look at the last CBA, and the coaches obviously complain about this all the time, but just they don't have as much time on the grass. So you've got to make the most of it. And talking to guys around the league, there's a lot more joint practices they're going to take place this year. We're seeing that trend really kind of crank up, and personally, I love it. You know, when you go watch the Chargers and the Saints practice together for several days, that's good work for both sides, and you're seeing different schemes and different players, and that, to me, is where you get the most meaningful work during training camp.
All right, so let's get into some of the players. If you're the Arizona Cardinals, for instance, and you've got Kyler Murray reporting today, what are you hoping to see from him between now and the season opener against Detroit?
Well, I think you're looking to see, can he adapt to the speed? And obviously we know how athletic he is, but just playing with better players as he's done from high school through college, he had time. He had time in the pocket, and if he wanted to be able to work deep into a progression or just wait for guys like Hollywood Brown to uncover down the field, he had that luxury. Now he's going to find out with the guys he's playing against and some of the weaknesses he has on his own team that's going to have to really, really speed up. So that, to me, is going to be the challenge for him to get some live reps and get out there and really kind of crank things up and get adjusted to the speed. I think he'll be able to do it, Jim, but it is going to be an adjustment for him.
Daniel Jeremiah joining us. Now, I want to get to your position prototype series in just a moment, but earlier this month, you tweeted out your top five MVP candidates for this year. Carson Wentz was at the top of the list. DJ, lay that out for me. Why do you like him as an MVP candidate this year?
Well, really a couple things. Number one, you look at the fact that when he was, you know, had that healthy run during the Super Bowl year until he got hurt, he was the front runner for the MVP. So I've seen him play at an MVP level. You look at some of the pieces that they've added around him. I think DeSean Jackson coming back to kind of complement what you have with an Alshon Jeffrey, with an Ertz, with a Dallas Goedert, who's a young emerging player. I think they have the pieces around him for him to be successful. And then really the last part of it is there's a motivation there. I mean, I know people say, oh, these guys are motivated. No, look, when you've heard, you know, the whispers from some of the people saying, hey, you know, look, Nick Foles was the one who hoisted the trophy. You know, can Carson do that? Can he lead us there? He hasn't done it yet through the postseason. So I think you see a guy that's really, really motivated, just got paid, and I think he's going to go out there and earn it this year.
Daniel Jeremiah joining us once again. Now, one of the ongoing stories during the offseason has been the Dallas Cowboys and the decisions that they have to make when it comes to contracts with Dak Prescott, Ezekiel Elliott, and Amari Cooper. DJ, if you're the Cowboys, how would you go about prioritizing those three players?
Well, I mean, I had to look it up the other day to see what would happen if Dak Prescott wasn't there. And I'm not all that fired up about that prospect. So to me, I'm starting with the most important position, and I'm gonna get Dak Prescott done. He's shown enough. To me, there's enough of a track record there. You look at some of the big moments. He's got a bunch of comeback wins. He's been in the postseason. I think that you've seen enough to build around him. And you're going to feel, you're not going to feel great about the contract you give him right now. You're going to say, man, I probably overpaid a little bit. And then you're going to fast forward a year from now, and you're going to be like, yeah, that's actually a pretty good deal because the quarterback numbers are just going to continue to climb. That being said, I do think Zeke is different than any other running back in the league right now in terms of his value. You know, where a guy like Melvin Gordon, if he wants to hold out, I don't know that that's going to end well for him because I think the Chargers would kind of move on and feel comfortable with what they have. But when you watch the Cowboys and the numbers back it up, Elliott draws a safety more than anybody else. He draws a loaded box, which does benefit everybody else around him. And the drop-off from Elliott to what's behind him is pretty significant. So while I would start with the quarterback because it's the most important position, you've got to get both those guys taken care of. I don't think the Cowboys are going anywhere if they're missing one of the two.
Daniel Jeremiah, my guest. All right, so stay on the quarterback. You and Bucky have been doing a position prototype series on the Move the Sticks podcast. Like, when you evaluate quarterbacks, you've talked to other experts like Kurt Warner, Mike Holmgren, David Carr. What are the qualities that make up a prototypical quarterback?
Well, I mean, there's certain things that they all have in common, and I start with really kind of the big three. And that's, you're talking about poise, you're talking about accuracy, and you're talking about decision-making. If that's the foundation you build upon, you've got a pretty good start there. Now, when we talked about it, it was fun having those kind of nuanced discussions with those guys because I don't think, you know, some people say arm strength does not matter. Well, it does. I mean, if you can't throw the ball more than 20 yards, you can't play quarterback. You've got to have the line. You've got to have enough arm strength. You've got to have enough mobility. But then those other three are the foundation which you build upon. And you talk to guys like Mike Holmgren, who've seen so many great ones come through there. They all do share those things in common, and there's some other things that make them unique, but that's where you start.
Now, of those three things, of course, size was not mentioned. The phrase prototypical size gets used quite a bit. But when you were with the Ravens, you did a study of great quarterbacks. How much did greatness come down to size? And you mentioned arm strength. And then how much did it come down to something else? Like, how important was size?
It wasn't. It wasn't a factor. And, you know, you kind of look through even some of the great quarterbacks. And Jim, you've stood next to Joe Montana. If you didn't recognize the face and you saw Joe Montana's body in the mall, you wouldn't know if he worked there or if he was a Hall of Fame quarterback shopping there. So it has nothing to do with the size component. But when you look at the skills, that's the on the field stuff. And then I go back to a conversation I had with Steve Young, when we were talking about quarterbacks many, many years ago. And I asked him, you know, in your opinion, what's that one defining trait for the great ones like yourself? And he said, it's those guys that step into a huddle and have that competitiveness and that drive to say, over my dead body, are we going to lose this football game? And when he said that, Tom Brady's the first name that came into my mind. Like, those guys have a little something different inside of them.
And then on top of that list, you had poise. And we're talking about that, too, of course. When you look at the guys playing quarterback right now, who are the quarterbacks who have the most poise?
Wow, that's a good one. You know, sometimes I think we think of poise and we think of somebody, you know, Tom Brady's a great image of that because he's so poised and comfortable and calm in the pocket. I actually think Russell Wilson, even though he moves around a lot, there's a poise that even when there's some chaos around him and he's on the move, he's never out of control. He's always in control of his situation, no matter how busy it gets around him. And that's, again, that's that thing that all those great quarterbacks have. It might look a little bit different, but there's a calm amidst the storm. And to me, Russell Wilson's a great example of somebody like that.
Daniel Jeremiah joining us for a couple of more moments. All right, so DJ, what about the running back position? What does it take to be a prototypical running back? What are the attributes required to be great at that position?
Again, good question, Jim. And talking to guys, we talked with Terrell Davis, you know, Hall of Famer, and Maurice Jones-Drew. We had some great conversations. And really, to me, you've got to start with vision, because if you're the biggest, fastest, strongest guy and you run in the back of your offensive lineman, it does me no good. So having that vision is where you start. It's a good instinctive position. You've got to have a feel for it. So those are things you got to have. And then to me, I look at it, it's pretty simple. We don't need to make it complicated. Can you run inside with power and finish runs? Do you have enough juice to get to the perimeter to run outside? And then what it comes down to is you're going to have a free man. It doesn't matter if you're running inside, outside. There's going to be a free man. And can you get by that free man by either making him miss, running through him, running away from him? That's where the great running backs differentiate themselves. The play gets you so many yards, and then it's you versus another human being, and can you get past him? That's what it is.
All right, DJ, you are a San Diego County legend. Earlier this month, you ran in the 4th of July 5K on Coronado Island. How'd that go for you? Did you hold your own?
Oh, man, I thought I was doing okay, Jim. Went down there, ran with my daughter. She runs track, so she was so far out of sight. I didn't see her finish. She was so far ahead of me. But I got to about the last half mile, and I'm like, okay, I've got a little left. It's time to get the kick. So I engaged the kick, and I think, okay, now we've taken it up a notch. And about that time, I think there were two 8-year-olds that went just smoking past me, and that was a very humbling experience. My goal, though, was a finish, and if I could beat anybody that was pushing the stroller, like I can't have the stroller go by me because that's defeating. But I never had the 8-year-old thing in my mind, and I think that was actually worse.
Yeah, not the 8-year-old thing in your mind, and it was 2 8-year-olds who blew right by you. Are you going to drop a time on me? What did you finish in?
Sure, I ran it a couple years ago and was like 25 and change. This one was right at 28 minutes, maybe a little over 28 minutes. So I was under the 10 minute mile. I mean, that's embarrassing. You got to get under that, right? So I think it was like 9 and change in terms of the mile average, but. I got there, and I was way too tired for having run such a short distance.
Nah, you're good, DJ. If you're under 30 minutes, I would imagine you're good. All right, last thought. As long as we're talking San Diego, you have carved out a reputation evaluating NFL players. What is your evaluation, though, of Padres shortstop Fernando Tatis Jr.?
Oh, he's a freak show, man. You know, look, as a Padres fan, I don't know what it says about us, but, like, him getting out of a pickle the other day was, like, the best thing I've ever seen. You know, he's just, to be that young and to have that combination of skills and instincts, it's just stupid. I don't know if you saw it the other day. I saw Eric Burns, who I love on MLB Network. Like, he went on like a 5-minute, just went off on how much he loves this kid and how special he is. So, look, we're not going to win anything anytime soon, but that kid's going to be fun to watch for a very long time.
This is a huge Burnsy house. We love Eric Burns here, and I know exactly what you're talking about. You mean when he went back to first and went all Matrix with it to avoid the tag? So good.
Yeah, stupid. I don't know how you bend like that.
All right, so LeBron James is a lot of things. Superstar, general manager, celebrity, general manager, actor, producer, general manager, coach, general manager, and general manager, to name a few. Oh, and general manager. He's also a dad and a general manager, but a dad nonetheless. And apparently he's a massive enthusiast of Taco Tuesday. And aren't we all? And both his dad flag and his taco flag were flying sky high yesterday from his backyard in Los Angeles on his Instagram account. Hey, man, no hate. No hate. I'm not setting this up like that. No hate. I'm a dad. I love tacos. Who doesn't? I just don't think that anybody can really say they love them as much as LeBron does after watching his IG story last night. Now, let me start with the threads that LBJ wore to the dinner table, because it's the very first thing he mentions in the video, which I'm going to roll for you in a second. The shirt, King Taco, that he was wearing last night said, "It's Tuesday somewhere."
How do you guys love my t-shirt? It's Tuesday somewhere.
How do you guys like my t-shirt? It's Tuesday somewhere.
It's Tuesday somewhere.
All right, you know, that's him being, you know, dorky dad, I get it. How you kids like my shirt? It's Tuesday somewhere.
It's Tuesday somewhere.
Yeah, dad, we can read. You kids call me King. You know that. It's Tuesday somewhere. Good one, Your Highness.
Somewhere.
Be even better if you wore it on any other day but Tuesday. I mean, you get the joke, right? The it's 5 o'clock somewhere joke. It's a joke because it's not 5 o'clock where you're drinking, but it is somewhere, but not where you are. So the joke doesn't work if you're wearing a It's Tuesday shirt somewhere on Tuesday. Rock it on a Monday or even on a Wednesday. Essentially any day but Tuesday.
It's Tuesday somewhere.
Good one, King. Anyway, you gotta love a grown man who dresses up for his theme meal of the week. Look, I really don't have a problem with the shirt other than it's on par with old guy's rule or female body inspector FBI T. You know, that some tool would buy down at the beach. But this isn't really about the shirt. It's more about LeBron's hype for some tacos. Listen to this dude howl to the moon about Taco Tuesday and then go around the table to all of his family members and Anthony Davis to get some group participation.
How do you guys love my t-shirt? It's Tuesday somewhere, so you know what that means. It's Taco Tuesday! Dior, what is it today? Bryce, what is it? Savannah, what is it? It's Taco Tuesday. Why are you so cold? We got new people here for Taco. What is it? Taco Tuesday. You think you're out of it, Ronnie? What is it?
Taco Tuesday.
Taco Tuesday.
Bro. Taco Tuesday or Tequila Tuesday. Damn. I think I speak for everybody when I say, strive for Taco Tuesday out here, cuz!
Strive for Taco Tuesday! It's out here, cuz!
Now look, if you think I'm about to shred this guy like a fine block of four blend Mexican cheese, I'm not. You know why? It's 2019. This is a father of three, and he's got his entire family around the table for dinner. That's a bigger win than anything he'll get on the court this year. You know how hard it is to get all your kids in the same place at the same time for a dinner? That's big, especially for a guy like that and a family like that. That's a huge victory for dads everywhere. And I love that Anthony Davis is already hanging out with LeBron's fam. That's chemistry right there. Nothing brings a team together like waking up the neighbors with a ritualistic chanting of Taco Tuesday!
Taco Tuesday!
Taco Tuesday!
Taco Tuesday!
You know, AD was just stoked to actually get tacos when he was told by LeBron that he was getting tacos. Especially he was told by LeBron that he was getting number 23, only to find out that Nike had already made up all of LeBron's gamers for next season and flexed on the Lakers to delay that change for one more year for production reasons. See, we learned this past week that nobody is ever going to want, say, a Super Bowl more than Mike Vrabel, or that anybody's ever going to want anything more than Mike Vrabel wants a Super Bowl. He was willing to lop off his Johnson for it. But now we know nobody wants anything or loves anything more than LeBron loves tacos, except for maybe James Kelly, who tattoos the Del Taco drive-thru every single day and crushes six hard shells at a setting. Now, what I'd give to see the flight deck randomly show up in a LeBron video, inhaling tacos at a half dozen clip on Taco Tuesday.
Taco Tuesday.
Man, poor Alex Caruso. Probably watching Instagram last night, sitting all alone in a Jack-in-the-Box parking lot, nibbling on wet envelopes of cat food. J-Bo's Tacos, hoping that one day LeBron learns his name. Good news, Laker fans. I'll have it for you next hour.
Taco Tuesday!
Hey, stay tuned. Tony Luffman is joining us. Tony, what's up?
Fellow clones, I want you to know that this show has made me a better dad. When my son wakes up from his naps roam, I give him the Willie and Casey, all those kisses, and let's go meet Mr. Rome. And it cracks me up. My wife doesn't get it. My son is too young to get it, but I enjoy it every single time I do it.
Nice job, Tony. He'll understand one day. He will understand one day, and he will thank you. All right, so with that said, you are an unabashed baseball fan. You love the game. You always have. How much fun are you having with Change Up and a Zone?
So much fun, and I appreciate you having me on. Logan Swaim, friend of both of ours, a creative genius. If he had come to me and said, hey, I'm getting ready to open up a Blockbuster Video, I still would have been on board just because I have that much confidence in him. This is such a good idea. You and I both know what Logan has done with Kyle Brandt and how good his direction was with Good Morning Football. He's doing the same kind of creative work with what we're doing at MLB Network. It is so much fun, and it is, as a baseball fan, it's the kind of show you want to watch and be a part of. I enjoy it every night.
Good for you. Tony Loveman is joining us. All right, so last night the Dodgers beat the Red Sox. Well, actually, let me go back, Tony, to Sunday night. They beat them Sunday night in 12. Then they get into Philadelphia around dawn. Then they smash the Phillies 16-2 on Monday night. How impressed were you by those two performances?
So impressed. I think back to something that Coach Wooden used to say, when success turns your head, you face failure. You've talked about the Buffalo Bills. We all have over the years. It's remarkable. Troy Aikman himself said it was more impressive what they did, going to four straight Super Bowls and not winning them and staying hungry and getting back. The fact that the Dodgers have lost two World Series, and we know how tough it is in L.A. It's a great entertainment town, but not the most rabid sports town. The fact that Dave Roberts, a fellow Bruin, has kept this team on task, and you could make the case this is their best regular season. At one point last year, they were 10 games under 500, and I was starting to press the panic button. This year, they are a juggernaut, absolute juggernaut, and going into Boston when the pitching matchups weren't the most favorable and really sticking it to the Red Sox, that was a huge statement.
It's nearly impossible to get back after losing the World Series, and yet they've done that a couple of times, but the bullpen may be an issue. As an example, last night, Kenley Jansen comes in, he gets the first out, then he gives up a double, then a single, then another single, and then Bryce Harper walks it off with a double. You are a professional broadcaster, but did I see you drop into the fetal position below your desk when that happened last night?
You did, and I got to be honest with you. One of the only reasons I'm comfortable doing this is because I remember when the Gauchos went to the NCAA tournament, how all in you were. I was like, if the Hall of Famer, and you deserve to be a Hall of Famer, if the Hall of Famer can be that passionate about his team, then I can do it. So I do. I make no effort to hide my Dodger fandom. And it's because of that that I can say this. I've enjoyed watching Kenley Jansen. No one will ever be a better number 74 in Los Angeles than Merlin Olsen. We all understand this. But last night, after that collapse, he said, I shouldn't have been out there. Not to make excuses, but I shouldn't have been out there. I go back to the wisdom of the great Jim Herrick, who said to Charles O'Bannon after we had our practice at the Kingdome before the Final Four, if you can't dunk, don't dunk. So, Kenley, if you can't play, don't play.
To that point, Tony, he got that first out by taking that shot off the ankle that went to David Fries at first base, and then he blew the save, and he was saying that he could not push off as he was pitching. Quote, I'm not an excuses guy, but I should have come out of the game. I mean, so Tony, when somebody starts a sentence with, I'm not an excuses guy, are they not about to make an excuse?
That's the point. You've taught us this over the years. One of my favorite things you do is you'll take post-game sound and do exactly what you just did, which is make the point that this was totally avoidable. He is the guy with the ball in his hand. He could have waved it and said, hey, Skip, hey, Dave Roberts, Doc, come on out. I can't keep going. I get that we want to celebrate and give tremendous credit to the guys who are mentally tough, physically tough, Willis Reed and Curt Schilling and down through time. But he was not effective. And then as they're walking off, he's limping off. And he wasn't limping off like Kirk Gibson doing the celebration as he's going around the bases in 88. It was just hard to watch, Rome. He has not been nearly as effective this year in the regular season. I don't have a great deal of confidence in him in that closer role.
At least he walked it off, Tony. At least he didn't go Paul Pierce. In fact, he should have gone Paul Pierce. He should have said, give me a wheelchair, man. Wheel me off this thing. They're going to have to probably amputate that ankle. Brutal yes. Loss for them. All right, so Cody Bellinger homers again last night. Tony Loveman, my guest. He leads the National League in home runs, runs, OPS. He's second in batting average, RBI, slugging percentage. There's no doubt. Mike Trout is the best player in baseball, but is Bellinger starting to approach that level?
He sure seems like he is, and he's on this unbelievable arc. There was a gap in his swing that they were able to take advantage of in the World Series, and then last year, obviously, they were afraid of lefty-lefty matchups. I feel like the sky's the limit for him. We see Mike Trout and his frame and his build, and there's no doubt, I agree with you, he is the best player in the world. I'll share this about Cody Bellinger. A scout said, since Bo Jackson left the major leagues, he was the best athlete anyone had ever seen at his time. Bellinger is the most complete athlete since then. Now, Cody's not going to run through Brian Bosworth and do all the amazing things Bo did, But as a frame of comparison, if you're mentioned in the same breath as that guy, that's extraordinary. And his ability defensively, I feel like he is gaining on Trout, although Trout is just so special.
Tony Loveman talking some baseball with us. Tony, the Giants have won 12 of 15. How impressed are you with the way they've turned things around?
It is the most entertained I've been by anything from Northern California since Vic in NoCal made his call to you about the whole Tiger Woods cheating scandal, and he called him Cheetah. That level of amazement, because full credit to Bruce Bochy, it's not like Will Clark is playing, right? They were struggling out of the gates. It's not like they had an infusion of all these legendary Giants from the past. This isn't 2010, 2012, 2014. Mad Bum is still there, but a lot of those guys are gone. This is a true representation of the significance and the impact that a manager can have. It's the farewell tour of Bruce Bochy. I love his voice. He could read a cereal box, Rome, and I would watch every press conference. The deep pipes, the commanding presence. I'm all in on Bruce Bochy, and I love watching his team.
I love Boch. We love Boch. This is a huge Bruce Bochy house. Now, if we're talking about managers and we're talking about Northern California baseball, we'll talk about another guy that I'm really big on, Bob Melvin. The A's are 18-5, Tony, in the last month. They're 35-16 in the past 2 months. They're 4.5 games out of the AL West. They're tied for second in the wild card spot. What's it say about Bob Melvin that pretty much every single year you can count on this team to make a run like this?
That's the exact point. Last year was the Tupac turnaround. I looked up the date where they turned it on last year happened to be the birthday of the great Tupac. California love, cue it, you know we all love it. The fact that they do this every year, and they do it at a fraction of the cost. You mentioned the Philadelphia Phillies. They spent $500 million last summer. Real Muto, obviously Bryce Harper, the 13-year deal, $330 million. The A's don't spend that kind of money, and yet they're competitive. Why? Brad Pitt, Ocean's 11, Moneyball. Incredible what Billy Bean has done. I admire the idea that you can be competitive on a year-to-year basis without shelling out $1 zillion. And they keep doing it. And one of the biggest reasons why is the guy you pointed out. Bob Melvin sets the tone. He is such a good manager.
Tony Loveman is a studio host with NHL Network and DAZN. Tony, before you go, I had Daniel Jeremiah from NFL Network on the program last hour, and he was talking about how pumped up he is about Fernando Tatis Jr. How do you explain this guy hitting .333, 14 bombs, 33 runs batted in just 55 games, and more importantly, at the age of 20?
You can't run away from the DNA, to borrow from the great Clark Kellogg. The second generation, obviously we remember his papa, but the thing about Tatis Jr., in addition to the maturity beyond his years, he throws, according to StatCast, harder than any shortstop in the big leagues. He made a play against the Dodgers and Austin Barnes, and you know I am a rabid Dodgers fan. I bleed Dodger blue. He ranged to his left towards the second base bag, made the stop, and threw the ball off of his knees, and it was a strike to get Barnes. It's the best play I've seen by a shortstop. We think back to Derek Jeter and Ozzie Smith and all these great plays where you're fading deep into the hole. I've never seen anyone make this kind of play. He's doing things we haven't seen before, and as you point out, he's 20 years old. The sky is the limit. If I'm a Padres fan, I'm excited, not about the distant future, the near future. This team is coming. They are really making progress, and as a Dodgers fan, I'm a little anxious about it. That six straight division crowns, hoping for a seventh, but I feel like the Padres are closing thanks to Tatis Jr. and Manny Machado, Will Myers. They've got some real talent. Eric Hosmer, they've spent the money in the right way, and I think they're on the come.
They've got a really good plan. They've got a really good farm system, and nothing ever lives up to the hype except Tatis. He's just smashing it. Tony, last thought before you go. You ranked the top five baseball video games of all time. You had MLB The Show 19 at number one. Tough to argue with that, but then you went old school with RBI Baseball and Baseball Stars at 2 and 3. Lay it out for me. Why RBI Baseball ahead of Baseball Stars?
Rome, I'm not much of an athlete. You know this. You've seen me up close. I'm not the most felt. I'm not the most athletic. So to me, the player shapes on RBI Baseball make the game seem accessible, make the game seem playable. Baseball Stars, the players are straight up and down. They all look like Cody Bellinger. Makes me not want to play. RBI Baseball, the ball bounce off of them and make that sound. I feel much more comfortable and confident playing with guys on the screen that look kind of like me. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Of course it makes sense. Tony Loughman, my guest. You can watch him co-host Change Up. It's DAZN's new daily MLB whip-around show throughout the season. And look for it tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern if you have not seen it. He is an NHL Network host. You hear that, Tony? I'm sending it out, sending you out with your song.
I dig it. Thank you so much.
We go to Falls Church. I jump him to the front of the line. Eric. Dude. Eric, what's going on?
First room, thanks for the flattering build-up. That was great. But I got to say, I mean, what are you doing with the show? I mean, you're letting lame clones rip on legends, and not only that, you let them copy them. I mean, Rick in Buffalo is basically doing a Jeff in Richmond. You let him play second in a smack-off. It doesn't even end with clones. Jeff in Southfield is ripping off Mitch Hedberg and let him into the smack-off. Hey, Memo of the Clones, if maybe you do a fire Chris Rock impression, just give us a call, do a few takes in his voice, and you're locked for the 2020 smack-off. But the worst thing besides Rick and Jeff getting ripped off was probably me getting ripped off on Monday by someone uncreative, unemployed, and ripping off perhaps the most prolific emailer in the history of the jungle. I'm talking about you, John, in Huntington Beach. So a trip down memory lane, about 10 years ago, I started producing my own emails, and Albie was dropping entrance music for when I got my emails read. The jungle was electric. I was dominating the email, dominating the clones. Then one day, Rome and I were doing one of our Vegas trips. Rome puts down his cup of sapphire, looks me in the eye, and says, Eric, my man, we need to give other clones a chance to get on the show. Your emails are just too good. So that's how Rome and I came up with the idea of dropping less flattering songs behind my emails. Rome and I then started looking for artists who were struggling at the time and needed a boost on record sales, so we settled on Beck. We then started dropping Beck behind my emails, and Beck record sales started to skyrocket. Beck even contacted me and was begging me to email the show more, but eventually I decided the theme was too much, and I stopped emailing altogether. So, John, you can imitate me all you want, but you'll never accomplish what I did. You'll never get room to get Janet to hook you up with one of her cougar friends. You'll never get room to drop a special shout-out to you at the end of one of his TV shows. John, as someone with authority to do this, I am ripping Beck from you and overruling Room. You will now, however, get a classic jungle email bed behind your emails, but it'll be a different one than Beck. Albie, give me some Yakety Sax. That's right, John. Whenever you email your Eric and Falls Church impression, you'll hear Yakety Sax email behind song behind your emails. That's exactly who you are, John. Clown music for a clown person. Jeff and Richmond and I are from the great state of Virginia, a state that excels in wealth, college sports, and legal gun ownership. John, you are from California, a state that excels in homelessness, bankruptcy, drug use, porn, and BO. Stay in your lane, John. Try ripping off another emailer. Try maybe taking a lame emailer like Chris in St. Pete. Make him funny. That would be worth the time and worth the effort. Albie, cut to John and Huntington Beach music and pump me some Beck. I want to end this call with some words. So this call is signed Eric and Falls Church. War Room bringing the liquor, me bringing the females. War Room and I hitting the bars and doing Top Gun reverse high-fives to perfection after every shot of liquor. War Room sending Jake to college close to Falls Church so I can mentor him. Room, see you this weekend. Usual spot. I'm out.
We go to Lincoln. Geoff, what's up?
What's up, Romy?
Yo, dude, hey, are you sure you're up for this?
So I'm up for it. If you're up for it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Eric and Falls Church. Big loser, obviously. He gets his own walk-up music. But there is a bigger loser in the jungle by the name of Matt in L.A. And I wrote a little song for his walk-up music. It goes a little something like this. Ooka chaka, ooka, ooka, ooka chaka, ooka. Matt can't fight this feeling. He likes to smoke the tree. Occasionally he likes to dabble in the PTP. Ooka chaka.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Trash.
Good night now!